Hi, and welcome back to the New Book in Genocide Studies podcast, part of the New Books network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall, and I'm your host. Every month or so, I interview the author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Today, I'll be interviewing John Roth and Carol Rittner, editors of the disturbing new volume, Rape, Weapon of War and Genocide, published by Paragon House. Roth and Rittner begin the book by pointing out that while rape has always been part of individual experience of warfare, only recently have states and armies begun to use large-scale rape as a tactic to help them achieve their goals. Accordingly, the study of rape and mass violence is also new. Thus, the book is an exploration of the field more than an effort to offer overarching conclusions. Still, the essays here offer a broad survey of the state of research, as well as issuing an impassioned call for action. John and Carol have the kind of easy familiarity that comes from having worked together for 20 years. The result is more of a conversation than an interview. I threw in some guiding questions, but mostly sat back and enjoyed the chance to hear two experts talk with each other about a subject of pressing importance. I hope you'll appreciate the chance to do the same. So, here's the interview. Hi, John. Hi, Carol. How are you guys doing today?
Hi, Kelly. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, thanks, Kelly. This is a very interesting way to communicate about our book, and it's great to be able to be in conversation with you and with John.
Wonderful. I can't say how happy I am that you've agreed to do this. For our listeners, today I'm talking with John Roth and Carol Rittner, editors of the really fine new volume titled Rape, Weapon of War and Genocide, published by Paragon. The volume ranges widely, both topically and methodologically, and it's really a wonderful way to acquaint yourself with a wide variety of new research about the topic. So let's start, just if you might, John, by saying something about who you are and how you became interested in genocide studies and the Holocaust.
Yes, I've been working on the Holocaust and genocide for most of my academic career. I'm now an emeritus professor of philosophy from Claremont McKenna College in California, where I taught for more than 40 years. I got into study of the Holocaust largely from reading that I was doing when I was a young professor. In particular, I was influenced very heavily by Richard Rubenstein and particularly by Elie Wiesel. And as I read their writings, I felt I needed to find out more about the things they were discussing. And so now I describe myself as a philosopher who got tripped up by history. And the history I got tripped up by was basically the history of the Holocaust and then of genocide.
And is that your primary interest, or do you supplement that with some other things?
Well, I work primarily these days and in recent years on Holocaust studies and genocide studies. I'm particularly interested in the ethical issues and implications of these catastrophes.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Carol? How did you get to be interested in this?
Well, I happen to be a Roman Catholic nun, besides being a professor of Holocaust and genocide studies, and what really got me interested in this topic of first the Holocaust was as a very young nun, not so young anymore because I've taught for more than 35 years plus, but as a very young nun, I read Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Recall to Jewish and who survived Auschwitz, and search for meaning. I kept saying to myself, well, why didn't Christians help Jews to evade the Nazis? And because I just, there was a terrible side to Christian theology of anti-Judaism in so-called Christian society of anti-Semitism, I began to read more and more and to research more and more, really as a way of answering that question of why didn't Christians help Jews asked, and so that got me really studying and reading and researching. And then I had the good fortune, much like John did, of reading Elie Wiesel's book Night, which had a very profound influence on me. And then eventually I had the opportunity to work with Professor Wiesel, organizing some conferences in Washington, D.C., and then I was, for several years, the head of the foundation he started after he got the Nobel Peace Prize. And, of course, my study of the Holocaust and all of that, I mean, you can't study about the Holocaust and, of course, not think about today and about what's happening today. So that led me to begin to explore, particularly in the 90s, what was happening in Europe, in former Yugoslavia. There's, some people say it was genocide. Some say it was just horrible war crimes and civil war. But again, I was concerned about the Christian churches and particularly the Roman Catholic Church. And, of course, Rwanda in 1994. Rwanda, the most Christian, quote-unquote, country in all of Africa, in terms of its population, and also experienced between April and July of 1994, you know, one of the most vicious events. I mean, the genocide in 1994 in Rwanda is just horrific. And again, as a believing Christian, as I sometimes say to my students, as a professional Christian, because I am a Roman Catholic nun, mm-hmm. I was particularly interested in the churches, the Christian churches in Rwanda, and in particular the Roman Catholic Church. So this is sort of what got me into studying and writing about the Holocaust and about genocide. And like John, I'm also interested in the ethical and moral and theological issues that that these terrible historical events precipitate, at least in my mind.
And you and John have been working either explicitly together or kind of side by side on these things for a while. How did that happen?
Well, that's interesting. And I met John originally in about 1986 when I was working with Elie Wiesel, and I had this idea for a conference about the rescue of Jews during the Holocaust. And the late Harry James Cargas suggested to me that I invite John Roth to come to this conference that Professor Wiesel and I were organizing in Washington, D.C. And so I met him in 1986. He came to the conference, and I forget now exactly what his role was, but, you know, he either gave a paper or moderated a session or whatever, but then we sort of kept in touch. And when he and Michael Barenbaum published a book about, what's the exact title of that book, John, that you and Michael published about?
Well, it was a book that focused on the religious and philosophical implications of the Holocaust. And let me pick up the story here just for a minute, Carol, because Michael Barenbaum and I had put together this book of kind of what we regarded as classical texts that had emerged by that time. This was around 1990. And when Carol got a copy of the book, I got a phone call from her, and she said to me, "Where are the women?" And her prescient comment was correct. The book that Michael Barenbaum and I had done did have one or two texts that were written by women, but it was predominantly a male voice that was in this volume. And so Carol was wondering, what about the women? And this got us thinking, and Carol, maybe you can pick up the thread again there.
Right, right. I think, I later saw there was an essay by Lucy Davidovich in the book that John and Michael Barenbaum did, but I said, well, as we talked about women scholars, because I knew there was a lot of significant work being done by women scholars at the time that had been published, I said to John, maybe there's need for a book about women during the Holocaust. And so we talked about it, and we, in fact, decided to collaborate on a book. And so the book, Women During the Holocaust, was published by Paragon House, and it's still in print. I still, and maybe John does too, I still occasionally get emails from people, or I meet them at a conference, and they say, oh, that book really changed the direction for me and of the what I teach and how I teach. And so it was our intention in publishing the book about women during the Holocaust was to draw attention to the fact that the predominant voices, or at least the ones that seemed to be predominant at the time, were those of men. And I mean, really important voices, Wiesel and Barenboim and Roth and Rubinstein and all sorts of Yehuda Bauer, you know, very significant, important scholars. But there also are important female scholars and memoirs also by women. Everybody knew Elie Wiesel's book, Night, but not very many people knew Auschwitz and After. And I'm blanking now on the name of the author, the French woman. John, you might know.
Charlotte Delbo.
I'm sure you know. Yeah, Charlotte Delbo. You know, and so we wanted to draw attention to them. And that's what was the origin of our working together on some publishing projects.
Kelly, so, there's a connection between the early book that Carol and I did and the volume on rape that we're focusing about. So I'll maybe try to say just a word about that. We had noticed that in the scholarship and in the testimonies by women, there occasionally were allusions to what we could call sexual violence during the Holocaust. But this was not something that was much talked about. In fact, it could be argued that it was kind of a taboo subject, just as was the case originally about the attempt to bring gender considerations and a focus on women into the mainstream of Holocaust studies. That that was not the case 25 years ago, that there was a focus on these kinds of topics. Today, it is a central focus. I just came back a couple of months ago from an important conference at the University of Southern California that was focused entirely on sexual violence against women during the Holocaust. This is a topic that was advanced very much by a book recently published by Sonia Hedgepath and Rochelle Seidel. And so this topic is getting into the mainstream more and more. But what happened to me, at least, and I think Carol nudged me into this, was we became aware, especially with the violence that was taking place in the former Yugoslavia and in Rwanda in the 1990s, that sexual violence and rape in particular were being used as strategies and as policies even to perpetrate genocide. This was the thing we were thinking about. This hadn't been codified. It hadn't been criminalized in international law yet, but we were becoming aware of this. Well, this remained latent for a time, but then as things escalated and we began to see what was happening in Darfur and then in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the middle years of the 21st century, in the first decade of the 21st century, Carol, and here I'll put the ball back in her court, got an idea for another book, and that's the one that we're focused on today.
Right. And the other thing that I would just say is that if I could put it this way, rape has been around for a long time, and it's been around for a long time in war. And it, you know, unfortunately, probably from the beginning of wars, you know, women have suffered and have been sexually abused, raped, etc. But and even in terms of World War II and the Holocaust, it was almost it was a prize of war. Do you know, like it wasn't, as John said, it wasn't a strategy. But what we began to see in former Yugoslavia and Rwanda is this notion of, because they're such highly patriarchal societies and children take their ethnicity from the father, that if a mother is of one ethnic background, let's say in former Yugoslavia, the mother is a Bosnian Muslim, but is raped and impregnated by a Bosnian Serb, the ethnicity is Serb. The child who is born is a Serb. In mm-hmm. Rwanda, if a member of the Tutsi ethnic tribe is impregnated by a male of the Hutu ethnic tribe, the child's ethnic background was considered Hutu. And what really drew my attention to all of this, I mean, you know, you sort of think about rape as a danger, but Roy Gutman, who is a journalist and mm-hmm. was in former Yugoslavia, he was the first, or at least I don't know that he claims, but I've read that he was the first journalist to draw attention to this use by Serb soldiers of rape as a weapon. Now, don't misunderstand me. Across the board in former Yugoslavia, whether you were Croatian or Serbian or Bosnian Muslim, I want to say rape was across the board. But the Serbs, the Serb perpetrators against the Bosnian Muslims and Muslim women in particular, when women were telling what happened to the Bosnian Muslim women, were telling what happened to them during they and sort of, you know, allied with another survivor of rape. I mean, in one place and in another place, they would tell, and they would tell that these Serb soldiers who were paramilitaries who raped them literally were saying, like, now you will have a Serb, you will make Serb babies. And so it began, and this has like implications not only for the destruction of a woman and her most precious being, but also has implications for society and for the ethnic group and for destroying. I mean, as we know, the UN definition for genocide is very specific. And one is, you know, to destroy in whole or in part an ethnic, UN language is ethnical, an mm-hmm. ethnic group. And so this whole thing about rape being used as a weapon in former Yugoslavia and in Rwanda, and I said to John, you know, I think I can get a small amount of money. There's a fund that I have some access to at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania, where I'm on the board of trustees. And I said, it's not a lot of money, but let's think about having a seminar and inviting people to come to the seminar, you know, maybe 12 to 15 people, scholars, to the seminar and present papers about rape being used as a weapon and of war and genocide. And John, maybe you can pick up about the idea of why we had these orienting documents. Which, yes, I support.
Yes. When we gathered together, our group, and the group formed partly because of people that Carol and I knew, and then also a little bit by word of mouth, as we contacted one scholar or one colleague, and we said, who else do you know who might be interested in this? Pretty soon we had a group of about a dozen or more. And we convened and began to think right away not only about the papers that we had brought to share, but about a book. And our idea was that we wanted to produce a book that would have a number of features about it. One would be that while it was going to be focused on rape as a weapon of war and genocide, the title of the book, we needed to have expertise and scholarship that could deal with a number of different places where this problem has existed in the world. And I think that's one of the things that was driven home to us as we worked on this project. The issue of rape as policy is something that is in the early 21st century. By now, it's become widespread. There have been many, many places, regions of the world, where in one way or another, sexual violence, rape in particular, has been used as a as an instrument of policy to obtain objectives that that political groups, often governmental groups, want to achieve. So we had to have a group of scholars who could give some coverage to the global character of this problem, and we then also wanted to form the book so that it would have the following kind of audience. We wanted it to be accessible to general readers, but we also wanted it to be something that could be used in classrooms with college and university students. And we thought that one way to advance that goal would be to organize each chapter so that the author had selected some kind of a document that they thought was an important thing for a reader to know about. The document could be, for example, part of an oral testimony, or it might be a part of a trial transcript, or it might be an excerpt from a United Nations document that had taken up issues that were concerned with human rights and with genocide. And then the idea was each writer would select a document and then present that document, contextualize it, and reflect on it in a chapter that would be of moderate length. And then included in the chapter, there would be other resources, discussion questions. There would be a bibliography, and Carol and I committed ourselves to including what turns out to be a substantial list of websites, internet resources that shed further light on this topic, and also give students and readers an opportunity to see that there are things that people, ordinary people, can do to protest, perhaps to intervene, to raise awareness, and to help in some ways to call attention to this problem that we face, and maybe to do something about it to curb it.
And so
that was
also
the thrust of the book.
The other thing that we did, and which we've done in several other books that we've worked on together, is we put a timeline in. We wanted to, and of course, you know, any timeline, wherever you started, it's sort of an arbitrary decision. And I believe we decided to start our timeline with the rape of Nanking in the 1930s. I mean, we could have started earlier. We could have chosen the beginning of the 20th century and started with the Armenian Genocide, for example, or the Hereros in Southwest Africa. But we chose to start at the rape of Nanking because it's such a horrific event, and in fact that historical event is known to us as the rape of Nanking because of what Japanese soldiers who went amok did to Chinese civilians and Chinese soldiers in Nanking, which was the wartime capital of China. And of course, any timeline, it's selective. I'm sure some people will read the timeline and say, well, why isn't X in there? But we, you know, we did our best. We researched various books and we tried to check against things and to draw attention to the fact that, you know, this is not just something that just began in 1992. That there have been horrific events, and the timeline also, although we don't editorialize a whole lot in the timeline, we try to keep it kind of factual, but to try to show that rape begins to change, or the purpose. I'm searching for language here. The end result, the end result is still destruction and death and torture and all the rest of it. But that things begin to change, particularly following World War II, and as we begin to move into the last, 50 years or so, and in terms of how rape is literally used as a weapon. And so that's also in the book. And again, even in the book itself, I mean, there are websites, for example. As soon as we went to press, we found a website. We were like, how did we miss this website? There obviously we're not exhaustive either in the areas of the world that we covered, although we tried not to be only Eurocentric or Africa-centric in what we did. We do have Guatemala. I mean, mm-hmm. Could look at just on December the 10th, I think, was, there was a commemoration about what happened in El Salvador and the terrible massacre at El Molsi, I think is the way you say it. I'm not exactly sure, but where women were, wholesale raped by Salvadoran soldiers and then killed, and that there was a woman who survived it and who was able to testify. We were selective, obviously, and we could only, we didn't, I guess we could have had an encyclopedia of places of rape if we had tried to be absolutely inclusive. But we see this book, or I think it's fair to say, as the beginning. We expect other scholars are going to pick up on what we've done, expand, focus maybe on a particular area, or pick up on areas that we've not drawn attention to but need attention drawn to. So the book is intended to be useful, informative. It's intended to point students and interested readers and other scholars to resources that perhaps they are not aware of, to the websites, to, there's malarkey, so to speak, on YouTube, but there are some really excellent short clips of films or news programs that focus on this whole issue of rape as a weapon in different parts of the world. We've tried to draw attention to that as well.
Sure. And I have to say, as somebody who teaches a class on genocide studies, I'm really very impressed with the thoughtfulness of how you tried to make this book, how this book is designed to make it easy for students to kind of understand the very difficult material you're talking with. My attention was also drawn by the timeline,
mm-hmm.
and how that connects with something you all talked about a few minutes ago, which you can I get why you wanted to you envision this as saying, well, this happened before 1992. But as you suggested earlier, in one sense, what's astonishing about this timeline is how late in human history it starts. I mean, it does suggest something that's hit at in a number of these essays.
Mm-hmm.
And John, if you could talk about why, how does this change? How does this emerge over the last three quarters of a century?
Well, I think we're still trying to understand, particularly with reference to former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, how it comes about that that rape becomes policy, and how people are then enticed into carrying out that policy. One of the scholars in the book is James Waller, who for a long time has been interested in the question of how do you get people to commit mass atrocities, to commit mass murder. He's a social psychologist, and Jim Waller in his chapter in this book takes his methodology and tries to apply it to the question of how people are brought into a network of power relations that leads them to participate in the implementation of rapist policy. So this is something we're still struggling to understand. But there is a lateness about all of this that is rather important and interesting. It's only in the late 1990s, in a case coming out of the Rwandan genocide that indicted a man by the name of Jean-Paul Akiyesu, that we get an instance where rape is codified as being a genocidal act. That is, that rape can be an act of genocide. So this comes late in the day. One of the tragedies here is that the perpetrators of these atrocities are out in front and out ahead of international law. The international law is in a kind of catch-up mode. So it's only fairly recently now that we have international law established in a way that can make it clear that a person can be indicted for and found guilty of genocide. One of the acts that is genocidal is that of rape. And it's even fairly recently that rape itself has been defined in international law. In the book, we understand that there are different ways to understand what rape involves, and these have evolved in different legal proceedings. But as a kind of point of departure in the book, the way in which the contributors have thought about rape would fit with the way in which it was defined in the deliberations of the Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which defined rape. This is again in the late 1990s. That chamber defined rape as a physical invasion of a sexual nature committed on a person under circumstances which are coercive. So that's how we have thought of this concept, and what we're struggling with, I think, and when I say we, it's not just scholars, but in international law and in cases where there's our efforts to try to intervene and to protect people from these crimes, which can, by the way, be crimes that affect men as well as women. We find that there are instances where rape of men is taking place as policy too. So anyway, we tried to develop a way of thinking about this tragedy, this crime, in a way that was consonant with the way in which it had been defined in the deliberations of the Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda.
Although I think, I could be mistaken here, but if I'm not mistaken, Dagmar Herzog, who is the well-known German historian who has an essay in our book about men during the Holocaust and about gays who were German men who were terribly abused, and I think she's really talking about like rape, to my way of thinking, and I think the way as some scholars and commentators refer, rape is a kind of sexual violence, but sexual violence, it includes rape, but goes beyond rape, you know, sexual torture, etc. I mean, in her her essay is really about sexual torture of a man. And so I think, you know, so we're sort of limited are we limited to a certain extent, you know, the focus of this book? It's not about all kinds of sexual violence, which are also horrific, but it's about a form of sexual violence, rape. You know, the one thing I want to say, though, about this thing about international law and holding people accountable, I mean, to me, that's what is so horribly discouraging. We can mention one or two cases that have come before the criminal tribunals of former Yugoslavia or Rwanda. But really, rape as a weapon, there's like a culture of impunity. There is, and this, I think, is even more discouraging and more shocking and more angering to me. It's not, I mean, women have to be seen, well, it's in my little essay that I have, is which plays off of Catherine McKinnon's orienting document, Are Women Human? I mean, I think that's a real question. I think there are parts of the world, and let's just take the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, where women are property. And they're the property of men. And it isn't always, like I said that I was correcting papers before we got involved in this conversation, and I have a graduate student who just wrote a paper for me, an excellent paper on the motivations of perpetrators of rape in the Democratic Republic of Congo. You know, at least in terms of what he writes about, it isn't so much that rape is used as a weapon as it's used as a way for men who don't get paid by they're in the army of the government of the DRC. They don't get wages. They're poor. They're starving. They don't have proper equipment. They wake up hungry. They wake up angry. And they want something. And they take it from women. And they think they have a right. It isn't so much, if I could say, a crime of lust as it is I have a right to this. My government's not giving me what, but I can take this. And this being, I can take a woman and do with her as I wish. And when you start talking about 20 and 30 and 40,000 women having been raped, I mean, the question for me is, how do you ever have any kind of justice to hold, and I'll say these men, because it's men, how do you hold these men accountable? How do you punish them? How do you have any kind of justice for the victims? To me, as a woman, you know, it's shocking, and it's discouraging.
I think Kelly Carroll's right. She and I have worked on dark topics for a long, long time, and in my case, at least, nothing I've worked on as a writer or teacher or scholar has seemed to me more discouraging in some ways than the investigations that are reflected in this book on rape. But I would have to say that there are also things that we found in our research and study that can give at least glimpses of hope. One of them is the amazing resilience of many of the women who have suffered this abuse in that have been genocidal. Those many do not survive it at all, of course, but among those who have survived, the courage of these women to organize, to testify, and the testimony that they give comes at huge sacrifice because it requires them to relive what they've been through, and also it does not give them necessarily credit within their own societies where they are upon as people who are tainted or who have questionable legacies going forward. But their examples, their courage, plus the fact that in the book we try to locate, as was mentioned earlier, things that people can do to step forward, to call attention. One of my heroes in this area is the New York Times op-ed writer Nicholas Kristof, who has for several years been kind of leading voice in calling attention to rape as an instrument of war and genocide. And this has been, for me, a fine example that I think shows how people can use the influence and the leverage that they have to do some good in the world. And all of us have a little bit of influence and a little bit of power, and we have to watch for ways in which we can do that. And I want to just say for myself, it's been very important to me personally to be involved in this particular book project as a man. I think that sometimes there is an impression that this is just an issue that's of concern to women. But it's really much, much bigger than that. And part of the change that has to take place if rape is not to be continually used as a weapon of war and genocide is a change in cultural attitudes. I think Carol was alluding to some of this in her comments a moment ago. A change in attitudes that reflect primarily on men about how we think about the humanity of women. That's how I'd put it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with John. I mean, it is amazing to see the resilience of these women. And, if I didn't see some sparks of light, I wouldn't be able to do this work at all. But I still go back to this thing of until men, and John said, it's important for him as a man. I mean, we women aren't going to be able to change how men look at us. I mean, men are going to have to deal with that with each other. Let me just say another thing. I think is it Leanne DeRuth who talks about I believe in her essay about the role of, or she makes a, tries to make a case for saying about the role of the churches, the church probably, the Roman Catholic Church in particular, in its view about women and how this may have influenced subtly the views of men in some parts of the world toward women. One of the things that I believe needs to be done is, and this is something that shocked me enormously. In fact, I have an essay or two about this, but it's about the silence of the churches, the Christian churches, and in particular the Roman Catholic Church in the early 90s, about what was happening to women in former Yugoslavia and in Rwanda, and what men were doing to women in terms of raping them. There is a letter that came from Pope John Paul II to, I believe it's the Archbishop of Sarajevo. We don't have this. We may have it in the timeline, but we don't have an essay in the book about this. But the letter to the Archbishop is commenting on the number of women who have been raped and impregnated, and the letter is a plea by the Pope to the Archbishop and through him to the women of former Yugoslavia not to have abortions. Now, I'm not for abortion. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not advocating abortion. But there wasn't one word in this letter about the men who committed these rapes. It was all about the women allowing pregnancies to come to term and giving birth. The child was not worried about the complexity of the feelings that a woman must have about giving birth to a child who is conceived under such horrific circumstances. That to me is very troubling. And it's troubling to me that in particular, the Roman Catholic Church doesn't seem at its highest levels and medium levels, you know, bishops and archbishops and all the rest of them, that we don't get any pastoral help with these kinds of issues or any outright condemnation of the men who commit these horrific crimes. You know, the Vatican will condemn, and I use that word advisedly, people who talk about the ordination of women. And in fact, they threw out of a religious order, Ray Bourgeois, out of the Maryknolls just recently for participating in the ordination of a woman. There was no talk in Rwanda when Pope John Paul II sent his envoy, Archbishop Jadot, to Rwanda to say that the men who have committed these horrific crimes against women are excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church. And there were a lot of baptized Catholics in Rwanda who were Hutu who committed these horrific crimes, including some priests. There was no talk in former Yugoslavia of excommunicating Catholic Serbs or Croatians or Bosnians who committed rape against women, whatever ethnic group they were. I find that troubling. I find that silence troubling. And I guess that's all I'll say about it at this point.
Yeah, if I'm... One of the things that struck me reading a number of these essays is the way in which rape or the consequences of rape live on in ways that are different and possibly more substantial than those of death. Right. And I don't mean to suggest, John, you write an essay in your essay, you talk about how the dead speak in certain kind of ways. But the consequences of rape are different. And I wonder if and maybe you can start, John, if you can talk a little bit about that, about how the impact of rape shapes societies and peoples well after the conflict is done.
Yes, well, it lingers on in multiple ways. I would say three ways come to mind, at least. Among those who survive these atrocities, the memory is there, and it has to do with senses of identity. It has to do with senses of worth. It has to do with how they see their future, these women, and it has to do with ongoing physical problems that these women encounter, medical issues they encounter. The rape that is used as an instrument of war and genocide is so brutal that for women who survive it, they may have lifelong physical problems that they have to deal with. And we're still in the process of having to figure out in some cases what the surgical and medical procedures need to be in order to care for these women. And many of them do not have adequate care medically or psychologically. This is a big area of need. So the first area is the ongoing impact of this violence on the people who have suffered it. Then a second area, Carol mentioned, and this is related to the first, I think all these things are interrelated, is that by intention, very often, these rapes are intended to produce pregnancies. And the intention behind that is that the children that will be born from these encounters will not only be, how should we describe it? They will not have a clear sense of identity. Their mothers will be conflicted about them. And so in the next generation, you have the after effect of rape carrying on. The third area is, and then this is where the genocide comes to the fore. It's connected with the other two cases or instances that I pointed out too. But the use of rapist policy has a destructive effect on the social fabric, on the communities of the women and now in some cases the men too, who are victimized by the perpetrators of this. It causes ripple effects that affect the fabric of a community's life, its self-understanding, and even its future. And so in those three ways, the impact on the individual who suffers it, the generational qualities of it that may be carried on through pregnancies and birth or aborted births, the effect of that, and then thirdly, in this larger sense of how a community's life and self-understanding is affected by these acts of violence.
Yeah, I remember.
You also talked about this, but you know, the children left behind, you know, some of whom are raised by the mothers who gave birth to these unwanted children under such horrific circumstances and do the best they can. But every time they look at the child, they're reminded of what happened to them. So how, you know, we learn so much, or we're learning more and more about what happens to a child in utero when, you know, it knows, quote unquote, whether it's wanted or unwanted. You know, how this will affect even the future of the country. I mean, when you have large numbers, I'm not saying millions, but even if there are thousands of children who are the result of such horrific impregnations and births, how does that affect even the very future of a country? And then the whole the justice system, which I can't understand how there can be any kind of adequate punishment or justice for men who have committed these horrific crimes. So what does that do to the whole justice system and confidence that people have in government? And as John said, all of this stuff is interconnected. And it seems to me, and I don't know, I'm just speculating here, but it seems to me there's probably always unspoken trauma that lurks under the surface of everything, conversations, social family life, school life, a child's life, a woman's life. It's just always lurking there. And you know, to use a cliche, it's got to come out somewhere, sideways, if it doesn't come out directly, the anger, the depression. So I think it's a very complicated, and I also think it's complicated. A lot of this gets complicated as well, and again, we don't really get into this in the book, but think about these conflict areas of the world where it isn't the perpetrators of genocide who are committing this horrific rape, but sometimes it's the peacekeepers who are to keep the peace, including our own soldiers, you know, from the West. It's very, very complicated, and it's true. We do have suggestions about what we can do, and of course, none of us is the Messiah, so we simply do the best we can do to try to, like the little Dutch boy who put this mirror in the hole in the dike, we try to hold the water back so it don't come crashing over us.
Yeah, one of the things about this book, the commonalities in the essays, is the sense in which one of the reasons that the experience of rape lingers the way it does is the sense in which societies often blame the women themselves for being raped, or at least for not avoiding that. And you know, there's this phrase that's been around in Holocaust studies for a while about choiceless choices. I'm sorry, that one of your authors uses. And I'm wondering, do you have, this is partly specifically addressed at that and partly addressed to some of your broader comments. Are you hopeful when you look at the way the discussion is going that there will be the possibility of changing this?
John, maybe you want to tackle that one.
Yeah, I'll start, Kelly. Carol, I'm sure, will add. I think hopeful is too strong a word to use, but I take some inspiration from two of the sources that kind of have nurtured me along this long path I've been on of studying mass atrocities. I take some encouragement from the philosopher Albert Camus and his notion of resistance, that even though that you may not have great hope that you can solve and correct this problem, there is something that is going on here that is so fundamentally wrong that you cannot be fully human unless you find some way to resist it. So that's one point that I feel pretty strongly. And the second one I from Elie Wiesel, and he has taught me that despair is not the ending, it's the beginning. That is, that you as long as you have breath and life, you may have every reason to be despairing about a situation. You still have to decide what to do with your despair. And there are various things you can do with it. One is you can take that too as not the end point, but as the beginning. So, and I feel this very strongly as a man, I would say, going back to a point we discussed earlier. As I've worked on this book, I know I can't solve or stop this problem by myself, but I can do something about it. If it's only in my local situation, in the way in which I speak and talk and act, and so these are small things, but they aren't unimportant. Even small things are very important, it turns out, and they may lead to larger things. So there was nothing in working on this project that made me feel uplifted or made me feel that we were really getting to a solution about this. But I saw in the work that I did on this the absolute urgency and importance of refusing to give up and trying to do as much as we can to resist and to protest and to energize whatever powers we can mobilize to act in ways that might curb this violence.
I can only say amen to what John says. I mean, I'm still teaching, and I believe that I feel the same way. I mean, I'm not willing to despair about this. I don't think we're going to solve a problem. I think this is an issue that is, I mean, it's enormous. It has something to do with human nature and with the question of evil in the world, and how we try to deal with that. But what I try to do, I try to teach my students, to get them to think about some of these issues and questions, perhaps in a way that they hadn't thought about them before. I mean, that was the whole point of the little essay that I wrote when I asked students in class, "Are women human?" And it's like, "Are you joking?" Well, of course, women are human. And then, and you could see as I sort of went through this class this particular day a few years ago, you could see particularly the young men in the class, but also the women, starting to think about it. Oh, well, I never thought about that, or I never thought about that in this way. So I'm with John. I mean, we do what we can. I'm not willing to despair. I see our book as a contribution to getting students, teachers, the general reader, maybe even people in government, maybe even persons interested in international law or at the UN. I mean, we're going to try to get our book in the bookstore at the UN at the time of the Commission on the Status of Women, to get people thinking about these issues, and not just saying, well, it's very unfortunate that these things happen to women, but war is war. And I think we don't move with bulldozers, but we just sort of move with little small tiny steps, confident that we're doing our part to try to get people to think and reflect, and then to act in a way that's for human beings and for humanity, and not destructive of humanity. Whether those we are trying to encourage to think are students or clergy or bishops or popes or scholars or military people, to get them to think and to reflect, and to do what they can do in their areas.
That's a wonderful way to perhaps conclude. We've taken up a lot of your time. I just really quickly would say, I think one of the real benefits to the book that you've edited is, in fact, the way it points out that war isn't war, and that this is something new in terms of how governments and peoples approach it. And, of course, if it's relatively new, perhaps we can work toward making sure it doesn't have a long life. I do have one last question. What are you all working on now?
Well, I can I'm working on something that is totally unrelated to this, and that's a film that's almost finished about nuns. And I have to say, I just had a meeting about it, and met with the filmmaker yesterday, and very moving film. And so I'm working on that, and I would like to work on a book about. I'd like to do a book that would be a textbook about genocide, and that could be used with college and university students. So those are two things I'm working on at the moment.
You, John?
Two things. I've just published a volume that again, is a group effort. It's called Encountering the Stranger, and it's a trialogue, we're calling it, that involves Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And this is a volume where quite a bit of the work was done at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and the project was to see how interreligious discussions might be affected if the participants used the Holocaust as a kind of touchstone. The Holocaust, in this case, being an instance of a catastrophe that took place in part because a religious tradition ran amok, in this case, my own Christian tradition, and ran amok in its relationships to Jews and to the Jewish tradition. And so we brought a group of Muslims, Jews, and Christians together at the museum and in other places too to reflect on religious violence, on questions about hospitality from one side to another, and to see how paying some attention to the history of the Holocaust might influence and affect how these religious traditions engage with each other and interact with one another. Then the second project I'm working on has a close connection to the project on rape. I'm working on a volume, Torture.
Oh.
And one of the things that that we know is that rape, among other things, is torture and is used as such. So there's a connection there between the project that we've been discussing today and one of the things that I'm working on presently.
Well, I look forward to reading those. They sound wonderful, and I hope down the line, if we get a chance, you'll be on the program again. And I just want to say thanks so much. This has been a fascinating interview, and I know our listeners really appreciate it. And thanks for your time.
Thank you
thanks
very
to you,
much.
Kelly. It's been very interesting for us, too.
Thanks.
Wonderful. All right. Thanks so much. Take care.
Right. You too. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with John Roth and Carol Rittner, editors of the book Rape, Weapon of War and Genocide. I hope you enjoyed the interview and that you'll return to listen to more interviews on the New Books in Genocide Studies podcast, part of the New Books Network. Until next time, thanks for listening.